painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking, KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
On this episode of Artbeat, we visit with Billy Kermano. Billy is based here in southeastern Minnesota. His work is often about environment, politics, and more. Today, in part one, we learn how Billy began his career in art, what motivates him to create art, how he has been able to afford making art his full-time passion, and why he chooses to use satire and push his body to intense physical limits to make a statement. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you're listening to Artbeat.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What's going on with you artistically, but also with social responsibility lately?
The stuff I'm doing in New York, I'm not sure if that exactly fits this question. So I was working on the climate change piece for 3 years. I posted something on climate change every single day without missing a day, and culminated it with the nap on the bed of nails was sort of the that point in that project. And all of my work and stuff that I do will have that environmental stance. That's why I did stuff like swimming the river. But in New York, they do have a vial of water from the Mississippi River Swim is one of the pieces they're showing at the Center for Book Arts. I signed a contract with the Hemispheric Institute of Performance and Politics in New York, and they're preserving things from the swim project into the future. And I don't remember how many years it was. It's an astronomical number of years. They're at New York University. NYU is where their offices, their facilities are. But they have like the money and the technology to keep moving everything forward into new directions. And this is like a list of the things that they took for it. I wish I could remember the number of years they were going to be preserving it for, according to their contract.
Right.
Which, of course, I'll be long dead, so so I won't be able to do anything about it if they don't do it. But it's performance and politics. So all of the stuff that they're interested in is stuff that ties performance together with things like this. Okay, November. There's supposed to be at the Historical Society in Winona a veterans show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's really happening or not, because I was asked to be a part of it at one point, and I haven't heard anything since. So I don't know if it's going to happen. But I was going to be willing to let them have my tiger cage, which is, it's called the Tiger Cage on Wheels. It's for the expedient removal of detainees. And a lot of my work with Vietnam Veterans Against the War and other organizations like Veterans for Peace are to try and encourage peace, stop war, show the results of war. I believe that war is the biggest threat to everything, to the environment, to everything else. If you talk about like all the stuff I was working on about the change in climate, people would talk about getting a car that gets better gas mileage. That's going to help. Fighter jets, tanks, they don't get very good gas mileage. And then there's the aftermath of bombing and fires and debris flying around and all that sort of thing. So you may not think of stopping war as being an environmentalist thing to do, but it certainly is. You know, I don't know if I'm even going to be in that show anymore, because no one, if no one contacts you, you don't know what's up. But I'm doing a cartoon for a veteran newspaper, which all ties back to this as well. I want to keep working on things here and traveling less. So that's one of my goals, because I really don't like flying. I don't like the carbon footprint of flying. The last stuff I was doing in New York, I tried to go by train to do the stuff, and the train was getting held up by oil trains so often that I got into New York. Now, already you're taking a slower way of traveling because you're going by train. And then I ended up, it was either 6 or 8 hours late getting to New York, and either 6 or 8 hours late getting back to Chicago, because I was going to stay in Chicago for a little while. Very impractical to travel other than, I guess, bus or flying to get anywhere now. And flying is like a really bad choice. When I did the project to the Arctic Circle, I went entirely on public transportation to do that. And that's because public transportation is another one of my issues, because I see that, again, as an environmental issue and a very important one. I'm really sick to death of politics right now, so I'm not being very active in that way, except in doing my art, which goes to the bigger picture rather than who you have to elect to get to that bigger picture, because I'm not sure how much difference it makes in the long run. Because you have someone really conscientious that's got elected, that gets elected, then they have to fight with all the other people mm-hmm. that have also been elected that are not conscientious. And I think that's why I rely on satire and parody and stuff, because I think it's easier to get to people by entertaining them than by preaching to them.
When did you discover satire as a vehicle for your art and expression?
Well, it was very early, so I don't know. My earliest known work is called Kicks to Delight, and it was in my mother's stomach. And then I followed that up with Live Birth, which I did at the Milwaukee County General Hospital with the aid of Dr. Stoddard and some nurses, and of course my mother and father. And I came out smiling, and that was to the dismay of my three older brothers, because I started getting all the attention.
So, oh, no.
So this is this has been my life. This is, I think I've fully dedicated my life to art, which I think other people do, so I'm not going to say that I'm the only one doing that, but a lot of people can't devote as fully as I have, I think. You know, it's I have not raised a family that oftentimes interrupts people in their process. I guess I can go back to the war again. Like, experiencing war firsthand is one of the reasons that I know things about it. And when I came back from being at war, I first of all felt that I was trapped in a uniform when I was in the war. And when I came back from it, I was very angry, because I felt as though I had been tricked and cheated by my own government, and that stays with me.
You were probably treated by the public differently.
Well, I was treated by the public differently, but when you find out that the war that you go to fight, because, you know, I was very, well, we could say politically naive, and immature. I was still a teenager when I first was in the military. So I believed very much in U.S. values and in the United States saving the world during World War II and things like that. So I was more willing to go into the military than I maybe would think is healthy, even. And I was a paratrooper, and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. And then I got there, and I started realizing that the war was built on lies. I felt that the Vietnamese people that I actually met and talked to as best I could didn't really care who was in charge of the country. They wanted to raise their families. They wanted to, harvest their rice. They didn't really want mines and booby traps all over the place. They just wanted to live and raise their family. And that's probably true in most places. My being just out of high school, it becomes a thing like cheering for your football team or your basketball team or something like that. You go off to war. My high school had, I have been told it had the highest per capita killed in Vietnam of any school in the city of Milwaukee. And when I went to Vietnam, I already had some friends that had been killed there. And I was, of course, going to go and teach those Viet Cong a lesson. And then you find out just how foolish that whole thing is. Yeah, so when I came back from there, I did decide. I was an artist before I left. I used to do portraits of people in high school and stuff like that, even though I never took an art class in high school. But anyhow, I was doing art at that time. But when I came back, I decided that that might be something worthy to devote my life to, art. It seemed a cleaner thing than a lot of other, like, if I was involved in politics, for example, there's all of this compromising and making deals. If you're making your own art, you don't really have to compromise. Unless you want to make the work really saleable, and then maybe you'll compromise somewhat. But I didn't think that would be the route I would take. I've gone around the country. This is one of the ways that I've made money, so I wouldn't have to compromise my artwork. I've gone around the country as a visiting artist and spent time at universities. And I've oftentimes told students that it's sometimes better to pick a job far from art as you can get, because while you're doing that job, like let's just say sweeping floors, while you're sweeping floors, you can think about the artwork you're going to make as soon as you get off work. And you don't have to worry about if you can sell it or not. You have your money from sweeping floors. If you have a job that's tied into art, like a professor at a college, for example, you might be spending so much time thinking about art during the day that you don't have time for it at night.
You burn out.
You burn out, yeah. Before I was as well-known, I'm not saying that I'm well-known, but as well-known as I am, I painted a lot of houses, roofed houses, I did all sorts of construction things like that so I could make the kind of art I wanted to make. And I think that it paid off because the kind of art that I wanted to make brought me to the attention of art departments, museums, that sort of thing. I sometimes wonder, I haven't been doing as much in Minnesota, and I think maybe I will start again, but I feel like in some ways I've been forgotten about here because I do stuff in so many other places. And I'm no longer trying to knock on every door or break down doors. Like the stuff that I'm doing in New York, they contacted me and asked me to do these things. And I like being asked more than I like asking, I guess.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you could say that. I don't know if I'm answering your questions or
you
not.
Are.
I'm kind of just rambling around
That's
here.
That's what I want.
I was talking to you when we were looking at the bed of nails about you using your body or pushing the physical boundaries to express yourself. Why do you like doing that, and what do you get from it?
Well, I do it because my body is the only thing that I really think I have, that I really kind of own. Van Gogh painted a lot of self-portraits. And when asked about it, you know, it's like one of those things, well, do you think that you look so good, or why would you paint so many self-portraits? Are you so big on yourself that you're doing all those self-portraits? And he said, well, I'm my own best model. And that's sort of true, that I have my body and I can do with it to a certain extent what I choose to do. And if I was to do these things to someone else's body, there would be questions that would come up. And it's easiest for me to talk about things that I've already done, because so much of my stuff relies on improvisation, having some kind of a plan, and then it oftentimes goes out of control. I lose control of it. But we'll take the River Project as an example. I thought putting I'm not a swimmer, I've never been a swimmer, I've had no swim training, putting myself in the river and saying that I'm attempting to swim it. I never said I was going to swim the length of the Mississippi. I always said I'm attempting to do this. Then people would think about the frailty of my body in the massive Mississippi River. And it would make them think more about it. And I've always felt that I was reclaiming the river in a way by saying, I want to be able to swim in this river. I want people to be able to fish in this river. I don't want it to be used just for transportation or as a repository of waste. You know, I want this to be swimmable. the bed of nails, because you were talking about there, it bothers me that our culture and, like, you can compare different cultures, and ours is very fast-paced, and we think that's very good. Is it? Then we look at the damage to the planet, and we look about someone with a much simpler lifestyle, and we wonder, who's happier? Is someone living in a hut, raising their family, having a nice meal when they make their food, and that? Are they any less happy than we are, racing from one appointment to another, spending times cooped up in cars, like the amount of time that people spend commuting, so we can have more things, and then oftentimes we don't really have time to use the things that we're getting. And so simplicity, there's the slow cooking movement, there's all sorts of movements that talk about slowing down. And we look at the damage we've done to the planet in comparison to this person in this hut. And who's right? So I can't really say who's right. I would just like people to slow down. And it's so hard to do it. It's not your fault that you can't slow down. It's because of the culture you're born into. It's like, if I want to go to town, there's no bus service out here that's going to take me to town. I'm going to have to drive. That's why I like to stay here and not go to town that much. It's hard to slow down. It was hard to lay on my bed of nails. I wanted to demonstrate that it's not that easy to take a nap. As soon as I said that my project was about napping, everybody got behind it. Everybody talked about how they love to take naps. But they also talked about how I don't have time, though.
Difficult.
And how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was, may not have been the best way to demonstrate it, but it was something that came to me. And I really, really wanted to make the bed of nails. That was like, all of those nails were nailed in one at a time. You know, they were all pre-drilled. I painted the thing. I made a grid to make all the nails exactly 1 inch apart. Then I punched every one of those little dots with a punch. And then I went back with a drill and drilled it. And then, it was a drill that I put on a device that I could move it around the surface so it would go perfectly straight in. So every nail would be standing at attention. And then I had to go, I couldn't find the nails I needed in Winona because I wanted them to be long and shiny. So I had to go off for galvanized steel, I can't remember, they're 3.5 inch long nails.
Big. Yeah.
And then nail them in, and then I loved seeing how the way the black surface I had painted was cracking from the stress of all those nails being put into it. And then I know that I needed to have a blanket and pillow of tiny tacks because a bed of nails by itself is just kind of old hat.
Time to pull it, take it up a notch.
Yeah, and of course the tacks needed to be tiny to contrast with the nails. You wouldn't want to have big tacks in your blanket mm-hmm. and your pillow. Now this is another moment because I didn't point this out to you, and I will be right back.
Okay. Pooh Bear. You had to put tacks in Pooh Bear.
Of course, I needed to have a teddy or a Pooh Bear to sleep with. So he did undertake a serious operation. This is my blanket stitch where I sewed him back up. He
That's
was
not like a Build-A-Bear.
So, yes, I had to have a Pooh Bear to sleep with. And, of course, the Kevlar pajamas. I had to spend all this time. Now, there were 2,395 galvanized steel roofing nails in the bed of nails. The blanket has 2,766 galvanized steel half-inch cut tacks. The pillow has 640 black steel half-inch cut tacks. And, of course, I had to make Kevlar pajamas to sleep on that with. So after putting all of those things in one at a time, each of those tacks in the Pooh Bear was glued and pushed through. A drop of glue was put on each one. So they're in there solidly. Oh, the blanket, too. A drop of glue on each one and probably the pillow, too, I think.
So how long did it take you to complete the project?
Oh, it was pretty long. Putting time on it is partially difficult because I go into these things without being sure how I'm doing it, and there were some false starts. And it's sort of like the Kevlar pajamas. I hate to admit this, but I found that the nails that I had chosen and 1 inch apart made the Kevlar pajamas not quite strong enough for comfort when I was going to lay on this bed. And remember, this was for 24 hours mm-hmm. I was going to be on the bed, which in itself, staying put, well, I mean, I could get up to go to the bathroom because if you're taking a nap and you have to go to the bathroom, you get up. You know, you do. I mean, so I didn't see any problem with that, especially when you sit on the bed to lift your legs up and go in. All of your weight is on your butt. It turns out I had to cut little aluminum pads for my butt cheeks. And so and sew them into my Kevlar pajamas. So my Kevlar pajamas were actually souped up a little bit. It's a little bit beyond Kevlar. But I was serious about wanting to, like I said before, the first time I laid on the bed, when it was just for the photos that you've seen that I've used as artwork by adding more tacks and paint and stuff to the photographs. Well, when the photograph was taken, it was taken by my good friend Margarita Bauman. And when I got off the bed, my back looked like a pincushion of little red dots. And she said, "I'm not going to let you sleep on that bed. You can't sleep on that bed." And I said, "No, don't worry. I will figure it out."
There might not be much sleeping.
Yeah, there was not much sleeping. That's true. It was like it was actually a very difficult piece. I would have cramping. I actually added beyond the tin in my butt plates, I guess we could call them. I had to wear elbow guards. Because if I tried to move at all, my weight shifting to my elbow, it just punctured through the pajamas and everything. So I had to stay pretty much in the same position for the whole night. I could move a little bit, but every movement was painful and difficult. And I was really, I did it on the first day of spring, and so I was getting up with the spring dawn, and of course that was planned, you know, that's how it was going to happen, and I was really a kind of praying for the dawn
I would, yeah.
During some of those hours, and I know that I did drift in and out of something. It's sort of like sleep, but it was, I wouldn't do it again.
But you don't regret doing it.
I don't regret doing it at all. No. And I think I still think my bed of nails is one of my finest sculptures, and, it can stand on end. It's, made in such a way that it could I would like to recreate the entire room, in a museum. I think that's why it's set up like, you know, it's got a nameplate in front of it and everything. I see the whole piece as an installation. The entire thing, the whole 24 hours was recorded, too. There were, surveillance cameras. There were two surveillance cameras on me all night. So it can be proven that I did spend the whole night on there. Oh, and we had people monitoring, and they saw orbs of light floating around in the room only when I was in there. They were, Dirk Nelson, Steve Smith, and D.L. Hunt. They actually came back here, maybe it was a week or two later, to discuss the orbs of light. And I think David recorded what they were saying about it. But they were trying to, because they couldn't, you know, cars would go by and mm-hmm. stuff like that. There would be reflective things that could happen. But they were quite certain it wasn't anything like that. They couldn't put their finger on what was causing it. And the three of them talked about it for quite a while. And, you know, most of my projects, I've been into, like, tying fasting in with it. And, I can go all the way back to, like, the burial piece, because I think that's a good example. I was fasting for 4 days before I was buried, and then the 3 days while I was buried. And when you're fasting, things can happen inside your head.
Oh, yeah.
So you aren't sure if some of the things I was seeing were things that were in my head or out in the real world. And I've enjoyed playing with that. And that's one of the reasons I went to the 40-day juice and water fast in Death Valley, to see what would happen to me over a longer period of time doing that. And I'm trying to remember, I think I fasted before I was on the bed of nails, too, to add to the whole thing. It's funny, I don't remember that for sure. It's probably in my notes, though. I always, I always have journals that I keep of the things I'm doing.
Thanks again to Billy Cremano for inviting me into his home and studio for this in-depth interview. Tune in next week as we continue our discussion on Billy Cremano's life and art. More information on Billy Cremano can be found at www.billyx.net. I'm Terry Tensett, thanking you for listening to Art Beat.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.